Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. George Bush gave America's blessing to an historic shift in the basic terms of Israeli-Palestinian negotiations today. Israel out of Gaza, Israeli settlements implicitly permanent in the West Bank, and no right of return to Israel for displaced Palestinians. At Bush's side, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, author of The Change, was thrilled.
My plan will create a new and better reality for the state of Israel. And it also has the potential to create the right conditions to resume negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians.
President Bush's backing of Sharon's unilateral disengagement plan deeply angered Palestinian leaders, who said today it could mean the end of any moves toward peace. From his home in the West Bank town of Abu Dis, Palestinian Prime Minister Ahmed Kurey said that he was disappointed with what transpired in Washington and that President Bush had undermined the creation of a Palestinian state.
When the right of the states comes to kill the rights of the Palestinian people and to give awards and gifts to Mr. Sharon in this critical period, I don't see that there will be a roadmap even or peace process.
Bush and Sharon described today's bilateral agreement as getting real about peace. But this time, the new steps come into a very particular context. The U.S. is struggling with a war in Iraq. It is struggling with a war on terror. And it has committed to democratic reform in the Middle East. Not everyone is sure today's move will help with any of these. Tonight on Point, an historic agreement between Bush and Sharon, its implications for Israel, Palestinians, and American security. Questions on the table. Whose interests were served today? Is this a get-real step toward peace on Israel's borders, in Iraq, in the war on terror, or not? Is America doing enough for Israel? Is Israel doing enough for America? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now is Steve Weisman, chief diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times. He's been reporting on Sharon's visit to Washington. Good evening and welcome, Stephen Weisman.
Thank you. Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Steve, first to the main elements of the agreement, explicit and implicit, reached between Israel and the United States today.
I'm sorry. You want me to lay it out? I thought you did an excellent job.
Have we missed anything? We've got out of Gaza. We've got an implicit endorsement of a half dozen major Israeli settlements in the West Bank, but a pullback eventually of others?
Well, that's an unanswered question. I'm sorry for the confusion. I think you've got the highlights. The major news today is that the United States, for the first time explicitly and publicly, has endorsed the idea that Israel will not have to return to its borders before the 1967 war, and also that in a final settlement of the boundaries between Israel and the Palestinians, that the United States does not support the right of return for Palestinians to what the future Israel will be. Those steps, in turn, give political cover to Sharon to do something that is an extremely bitter pill for him and his government, which is withdrawing from settlements. And the only ones that Israel has said it would be willing to withdraw from now are a number in all of the ones in Gaza, which amount to about 7,500
Israelis
settlers,
there. Mm-hmm.
And another tiny handful in the northern part of the West Bank, only about 500 settlers in those. But they, although no one's saying this, they really do clear the way for an eventual, once you kind of set the precedent, I think the Israelis will come to recognize that a majority of the settlements, although not perhaps the majority of the settlers in the West Bank, will eventually have to be withdrawn.
Stephen Weisman, explain something for us. Big fireworks from Palestinian leaders today saying this is outrageous, this is a huge obstacle to peace. In fact, the peace process, whatever it may be, is over. But isn't what's emerging here something like what people expected to come out of a final agreement at the end of a long chain of negotiation?
Yes, that's exactly right. And indeed, President Clinton, in his final months of office, privately circulated maps and proposals that were accepted by the Israeli government of the time. Of course, it was not a conservative government. It was a labor government under Prime Minister Barak, mm-hmm. that ceded to Israel several or at least a few large settlement blocks that effectively have served over the decades as suburbs of Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. Now, of course, Israel, under those agreements, was supposed to then cede territory that it has historically had to the Palestinians, mm-hmm. And that was not part of today's agreement. But you're right. It's been acknowledged behind the scenes, even by some Palestinian leaders, that these settlements in particular were going to have to stay with Israel because it would be too politically impossible to dismantle them under any agreement.
So what is it then, Steve, that has the Palestinians so out of joint today, and in advance even Hosni Mubarak of Egypt on Monday warning against something like this happening? Is it that they feel that Bush and Sharon are sort of unilaterally giving away their negotiating cards before the real negotiation has even taken place?
That's exactly it. But remember, there aren't any negotiations taking place. And those who say that this is going to damage the peace process may be overlooking a simple fact, which is that their peace process has been at an impasse, and there's no prospect for it resuming. Israel and the United States say they won't resume it as long as Arafat seems to be in control of the Palestinian Authority. So There was not going to be any movement in the peace process, and Israel, recognizing that, turned to this unilateral withdrawal, which is very controversial in Israel.
That is, many Israelis, especially conservatives, don't support it.
That's right, although the politics of Israel, and others know more about this than I do, but Sharon's government and his base of support is very conservative and may have trouble swallowing this, but that doesn't mean that the majority of Israelis won't swallow it, and it's the expectation of some American officials, in fact, that even if Sharon's government falls over this and does not support it, eventually Sharon will form a new government with labor participation, a kind of unity government, and that government would be able to carry it out, and the expectation with a majority of Israelis supporting it.
Steve, let me ask you about the broader context for just a moment. You know, there's a critique out there that says, whatever the merits, if the Palestinians are furious about this, if the Arab world sees this as bullying, this doesn't help with George Bush's stated goal of succeeding in Iraq with democratization and a handover. It inflames sentiments there, and it inflames sentiments in the broader Middle East, where he's made the same kind of commitment to democracy and reform. What about that argument?
I think it's a good argument, and the only way it's going to help is if it truly leads to a withdrawal of settlements, and even though small, if Arabs see that this time Sharon is serious, and he really does dismantle settlements and pull them out of places. The administration is counting on that to really impress the Arabs. I mean, how can they be, and this is the view of the administration, against a plan that calls for a withdrawal of settlements? And forces from areas that are predominantly Palestinian. How possible is it for an Arab leader to say he's against that? That's what the administration is banking on. And they're saying that even that these guarantees that have been given by Washington today have only made explicit something that everybody already knew was implicit.
Stephen Weitzman, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Bethesda, Maryland, Dennis Ross. He was a key U.S., the key U.S. point person for Middle East peace negotiations in the first Bush and Clinton administrations. He's director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Good evening and welcome, Dennis Ross.
Nice to be with you.
It's wonderful to have you again. Dennis Ross, we read that there were months of negotiations going on between Washington and Israel over the letter signed today. What's the backstory as you read it here? Why has this emerged?
Well, I think we have to understand where the whole initiative came from. It's not an American initiative. It's mm-hmm. coming from Sharon. It's coming from pressures within Israel. The reality is that Ariel Sharon understood that he had to produce something. When the Geneva Accords were negotiated by non-official Israelis with quasi-official Palestinians, Sharon was very quick to condemn what it represented, and most of the Israeli public agreed with him.
This was a kind of shadow agreement that was meant to point the way toward a possible settlement.
Exactly, which was done, which was concluded in November, early
unofficial.
November.
Mm-hmm.
And while he was highly critical of it, and most of the Israeli public basically shared the criticism, there was also a very strong undercurrent and not so implicit throughout Israel that, fine, you don't like that answer, but what's yours? Mm-hmm. We can't just continue the way we are. We've had 900 dead in the last 3 years. We haven't had anything like this in our history with the Palestinians. The economy is in shambles. There's got to be a change. There's got to be a policy. What is your policy? So he previewed it initially in a speech in Herzliya in December.
Yes.
And then shortly after that, he declared that he would withdraw from Gaza. In effect, what then happened is that initially the administration was slow to embrace it, and then it realized, as Steve was saying, mm-hmm. well, how can you be against the idea that the Israelis are withdrawing from territory and are going to evacuate settlements unilaterally? And the key was, from the administration standpoint, I believe, to then try to work out some understanding so it would be easier to get international support for what the Israelis were doing. The reason I think it took some time is because the Israelis, in fact, were prepared to do more in terms of withdrawal in the West Bank, but wanted more from the administration.
Such as?
Well, I think they wanted explicit recognition of settlement blocks. And the fact is, I know the storyline here is that Israel is getting a kind of American acknowledgement of settlement blocks, but it's a very soft formulation.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is, if you look at the letter makes a reference specifically to what are these new realities on the ground, but it also says that any final status agreement that's to be achieved has to be achieved on the basis of mutually agreed changes that reflect these realities.
So there's more to be discussed here. Dennis Ross, we've got a break coming up. Before we get there, I want to put it to you. Does this may work or may not for the Israelis and Palestinians. Palestinians today say no. Does this work for the United States in its greater goals in Iraq, in the Middle East, in the war on terror, if it's exciting so much denunciation and anger in the Arab world?
It can work only in one way. We have to build on it to produce Palestinian responses to demonstrate not only that the Israelis are moving, but that this can become a critical way station for getting back to peacemaking. If it doesn't do that, if all you do is end up in a situation where the Israelis are throwing the keys over the fence in Gaza and hoping for the best, we're likely going to be creating new confrontation lines in the area and greater cynicism about us.
Stephen Weitzman, I know I've got to let you go in just a minute here, but what's your reading of the Bush administration's take on this? What is their depth of confidence that they can ride this forward to the kind of outcome Dennis Ross describes?
Well, this is an era of a lot of hopeful thinking in the administration that in Iraq and this situation that I guess some would call wishful thinking. I think that they have a lot of work cut out for them, as Dennis said, to keep the Europeans and Arabs behind this initiative by having it produce results. And their briefings today indicate that they feel this is a kind of turning point, and that they hope to be able to transform today's milestone into more results in the future. But it can't be done without a lot of cooperation and diplomacy, as Dennis said, with the United Nations, the Europeans, and the Arab countries, and overcoming a lot of skepticism and even cynicism there and in Iraq. So this, a lot of people said that an election year was going to be a quiet year for foreign policy and of standing still.
Mm.
And I think it's going to be more and more turbulent as the year unfolds.
Looks that way right now. Stephen Weitzman, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Stephen Wiseman, Chief Diplomatic Correspondent for the New York Times. Dennis Ross, please stand by. We are talking tonight about an historic agreement between George Bush and Ariel Sharon and questions about its impact on American security and the war in Iraq. You can join the conversation. How do you interpret today's big U.S.-Israel agreement? Whose interests are being served? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about an historic agreement between George Bush and Ariel Sharon and its implications for Israel, for the Palestinians, for American security. My guest tonight is Dennis Ross, key U.S. point person in Middle East peace negotiations and the first Bush and Clinton administrations, director of the Washington Institute for Near East Peace, author of the forthcoming book, The Missing Peace, The Inside Story of the Fight for Middle East Peace. You can join our conversation tonight as well. Is America doing enough for Israel? Is Israel acknowledging America's security needs and interests in this particular time? Does this agreement today between an American president and Israeli prime minister put Israel and the Palestinians closer to a just peace or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Dennis Ross, Stephen Wiseman raises the question whether this is hopeful thinking on the Bush administration's part or wishful thinking. How do you interpret it?
Well, I think at this stage it's still in the category of wishful thinking, but I think it can be transformed into what could be quite practical thinking. One of the reasons the Palestinians are so angry, and I think you put your finger on it earlier, is because they feel excluded.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are issues that they consider to be a central part of what they're going to negotiate in terms of their future. There are no negotiations. There effectively have been no negotiations for the last 3 years. We've
right.
not had a peace process for the last 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
If, in fact, they had been more involved in this process, if it had been a parallel process, not only with the Israelis but with them, then you might have managed, we might have been able to manage a very different kind of public Palestinian response, which, by the way, is important because it will influence the rest of the Arab world in terms of how they respond to this. So it's very important, I think, now to give the Palestinians a sense, A, that they should be reading the letter. The fact is, if you read the words in the letter, you'll realize there's much more scope for negotiation, much less room for preemption of real negotiations on the permanent status issues than is being publicly portrayed. And I think the Palestinians would do themselves a service actually to look at the words and then, when they have a chance to speak to the administration, to focus on their own version of clarifications. The administration, though, then has to become much more deeply involved than it's been. It can't just focus on, in a very limited way, only on one side. It's going to have to deal with the Palestinians. It's going to have to bring in the European Union. It's going to have to do, especially because of their capacity to put more pressure on the Palestinians to be responsive. I mean, bear in mind, the Palestinians have an enormous amount riding on this. Israel is getting out of Gaza, and someone's going to have to go and govern Gaza.
Right.
There can no longer be an excuse made by the Palestinians that we can't govern because the Israelis prevent us. In Gaza, that simply won't be true anymore. So they are going to face a challenge, and the whole world needs to communicate a message. All right, prove to everyone that you're up to statehood. Prove that you can assume real responsibilities and obligations. Tell us what you need to do it, and we're prepared to help. But if you don't do it, then you lose our support. Now, that can have a tremendous impact on what is a very fluid situation among Palestinians right now.
But isn't that essentially the message that has been given for a number of years when things didn't work out, and there were accusations that Palestinians didn't end up getting, that they had severe internal divisions and troubles, but also didn't end up getting the support from the United States, from Israel, that they needed to succeed. Is the dynamic different this time?
Well, the dynamic's different in one important respect. The Israelis won't be in Gaza. You see, in the past, what you had is the Palestinians could always say, we can't do what we're being asked to do because we're being limited. We're constrained. We don't have the power.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have the authority.
Mm-hmm.
The Israelis are there to block us. Well, that will simply not be the case in Gaza. In Gaza, they will be able to run things. And they themselves understand. I can tell you, having just been out there recently, when I spoke to Palestinians about Sharon is going to get out, and you can either be better off or you can be worse off, but you have to decide what you're prepared to do. Every Palestinian I spoke to, and I spoke to a very wide range of Palestinians, especially in what I would call the new guard of Fatah, they all said the same thing. They knew it was historic. They knew they had to get their act together. They had to overcome their own internal divisions. Now, there are a lot of things we can do to help. There are things the Israelis can do to help. The Israelis should be thinking about how they carry out the withdrawal in a way that benefits those who believe in coexistence and doesn't play into the hands of those who believe in violence and who believe in rejection.
Dennis Ross, stand by for a moment, if you would. I want to welcome into our conversation from Washington, Shibli Tilhami. He's Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland and a senior fellow at the Savant Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, author of the best-selling book, The Stakes, America in the Middle East. Good evening and welcome, Shibli Tilhami.
Good evening to you.
Shibli Tilhami, we're looking tonight at the Israeli-Palestinian relationship, at America's role there, but also at the broader context of the American war in Iraq, President Bush's announced goal of spreading democratic reform in the Middle East, and the overall war on terror. How do you see today's agreement between Bush and Sharon playing out in that larger context of American interests?
Well, let me put it in that larger context. I think from the point of view of both Iraq policy and democracy policy, it's going to be a troublesome development. I think democracy in the Middle East is even in more trouble tonight. Here is why. I think first, you know, when you look at what is transpiring in Iraq, we know that the pictures today, at least, are uninspiring, contrary to what had been anticipated before. And to the extent that Iraq might become a model that inspires people, it's going to have to wait 5, 10 more years. And the public in the region simply doesn't have the trust to wait. They're not going to go by promises. And today, what has transpired is, regardless of what the president said last night, this is going to be read in the Middle East. And Dennis makes very good points about why it is not as dramatic as some people might assume.
Okay.
The reality of it is that people in the region are going to see this as essentially adopting a Sharon plan that they don't like. And therefore, I think tonight they'll be even more suspicious and less cooperative. But the other reason I think why democracy is in more in trouble is, think about it this way. The idea behind this notion of spreading democracy was the U.S. is going to have a lot more leverage in the region after the war, and it's going to persuade Arab governments to come on board. Well, the reality of it is, right now the United States is needing those same Arab governments for two reasons. One is for the Iraq issue, and then also to get the cooperation in this case for the Israeli withdrawal.
Right.
And to do that, they have to go against the public opinion, which is highly against it. And so in order for them to do that, they're going to have to repress more. And in order for them to move forward, they have to support the U.S. more. And so in that environment, it's hard to see where democracy fits.
But Shibli Tilhami, let me ask you then, President Bush likes to present himself, and he essentially has again today, as a guy who cuts through the shibboleths and the nonsense and gets right to the heart of things. He said, if this is where we're going to end up, as Dennis Ross was saying, let's go straight there and then bring the Palestinians on board. I mean, do you see this as an exercise in getting real? And is it incumbent upon the Arab world to get real as well?
That sounds good, except for the following. I think that when you look at it, I think, you know, anybody who's realistic, and Dennis, I think, is one of those people who knows what it's going to look like. Anybody who's realistic understands that whatever the outcome is going to be, of course, there is going to be some parts of the West Bank annexed by Israel. The refugees is going to be settled in a way that's compatible with Israel. So in some ways, those steps are not as dramatic in the scope of a final status agreement. That's right. However, if you think about it differently, contrast this with the Clinton proposal. The Clinton proposal, first, was a proposal, not an American position. And second, when Clinton proposed such things as Israeli annexation of parts of the West Bank, he also proposed things that Israel is going to have to do, like control of parts of East Jerusalem.
Right.
Now, when you look at that, for example, and say, well, all right, so he's saying what the, you know, what's realistic for the Palestinians to have to accept, but he's not stating what the Israelis are going to have to accept. That's part of the problem here.
Leaving them in a much, I guess they would say, in a much weaker negotiating position in terms of getting to a final settlement they can live with. Shibli Tilhami, Dennis Ross, please stand by. A lot of callers want to join us. I would like to turn to them. Paul is calling from Billerica, Massachusetts. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi. Good evening to everyone.
Good evening.
I occasionally go over to Israel on business, and I was recently there, and I took away a couple of thoughts on the situation that you're discussing. One of them is the average Israeli, my colleagues over there, taxi drivers, whatever, there are people under siege. They have 300 million Arabs surrounding them who don't want to see them exist, and they think a lot differently than we do.
Yep, okay.
The other is that I think the recent development with Ariel Sharon withdrawing from the Gaza Strip is, I think, step one in an overall master plan that he and his cabinet have devised, and that is wanting to get the Palestinians out of the West Bank altogether.
And go where?
Well, there's a lot of area to be settled in Egypt and, you know, near Gaza Strip.
And, Paul, are you saying that you hear Israelis speculating about this on your recent visit there?
Yes.
Well, let us pick it up. Paul, thanks for your call. Dennis Ross, here you hear the fear or paranoia, label it however you like, that the master plan is not what George Bush is suggesting it is, but rather something different.
I think that Ariel Sharon may well have a design that is different than what President Bush envisions, but I don't think it's a transfer of the Palestinians from the West Bank. Maybe there was a period when he believed in that sort of approach, believing in Jordan as Palestine, but he doesn't accept it any longer. He certainly has certain people within his cabinet who will probably resist this, who are far more extreme in terms of how to deal with the question of the conflict. But I don't think that's a view that has much real credibility within Israel, even within the Sharon cabinet. Sharon would like to see some kind of arrangement that is a longer-term interim character applied to the West Bank. He hopes that what he's doing now puts him in a position where basically the onus is shifted to the other side and it's up to Palestinians to do something, not to him. He looks to the kind of assurance he gets from Bush not to be under the pressure to accept any other kind of initiative. So I think that's the general approach, but I don't think it's an approach that somehow says, well, you know, we'll find a way to depopulate the West Bank of Palestinians. On the contrary, the whole logic of building the barrier is itself to create a new security line, which is going to involve, I think, some real tough issues for the Israelis in terms of how they are able, in fact, to protect settlements that are on the, quote, wrong side of that fence.
Right, the other side. Let's, if we may, just pick up Shibli Talhami's point for a minute, though. If, as you describe, what Sharon has in mind is a long interim period where the Palestinians don't have what they want, but it's held out as a promise, and if that long interim period should coincide with the period when the United States is fighting a war on terror, trying to reform the Middle East and bring stability to Iraq, are these compatible, or is that too big a burr under the saddle of U.S. goals for them to work out?
And may I add just one more to this question, which is, think about the logic of the letter from the president to in his statement today in addressing Sharon, saying, taking into account the realities on the ground, mm-hmm.
Yes.
Which is, of course, the settlements. And think about the Palestinians, which have always feared that those realities on the ground will become realities that cannot be transcended.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're buying more time and you're building more settlements, what's the argument going to be in another 5 years?
Well,
and
I would
say that's the real fear here. That's a real, real strong fear that is likely to be there in the Palestinian community.
Dennis Ross, the real impact of that fear among Palestinians and Arabs on U.S. goals in the region.
Well, it would undercut them. There's no question it would undercut them. But again, let's also look at, just because Sharon wants something doesn't mean that's the way it's going to materialize. Now, it could well materialize that way if we see no change in Palestinian behavior. If we see basically a call for a continuing intifada, if we see continued violence, then you're going to find that it'll be much easier to sustain the position that I just described that Sharon might want to see in terms of a longer-term interim reality. On the other hand, if the Palestinians actually assume responsibilities in Gaza, if they're prepared, in fact, to assume responsibilities in areas that the Israelis withdraw from in the West Bank, not only settlements, but other areas they may withdraw to in light of building of the barrier, if the Israelis, in fact, lift checkpoints so that Palestinians have something like a return to normal life in the West Bank, then you're going to find that the demonstration that the Palestinians are prepared to fulfill their obligations and want there to be a political outcome will create its own set of pressures, so it's not going to be so easy to sustain a status quo in the West Bank. Then I think you'll find that we might actually generate the resumption of a real peace process. We have not had that for the last 3 years because the peace process implies that there's actually negotiations, that there's actually a dialogue of words, not a dialogue of violence. We've had only the latter for the last 3+ years.
Shibley Talhani, how about it? Dennis Ross suggesting, if I'm hearing him correctly, that the open hand hasn't worked. Here's a tougher approach, you kind of take it or leave it. Here's a real opportunity, but if you don't grab it, Palestinians, you may lose it. Is that more likely to work?
It hasn't worked in the past. I don't see how it can work now. Realistically, you know, for the Palestinians to take a tough approach, both in terms of against the militants and to a conciliatory approach toward Israel, there has to be an enhanced authority. And I think you're not likely to have an enhanced authority in this environment, particularly given where the public is going. When you're losing the public,
yeah,
and you're not acquiring sovereignty, the problem in Gaza, of course, is, you know, whatever happens after the Israeli withdrawal is still not going to be a sovereign state. It's still not going to have the powers of a sovereign state.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Palestinians are going to be still under very difficult conditions, and in this case perhaps cut off, in fact, from a possible employment line depending on what transpires.
Right.
So I think you're going to be operating under very difficult circumstances. I'm not very optimistic. I just have to say just one thing on this.
Boy, yeah.
I actually think, you know, in the end, it really isn't the American position that is going to define the outcome of the conflict.
Mm-hmm.
I really must say this.
Okay.
I think the U.S. has a role to play, and I think Dennis is absolutely right in that. Without the U.S. having a strong peace process that has the relative trust, doesn't have to be equal trust, but the relative basic trust of both sides, you're not going to revive any confidence in any possible negotiated outcome. They've both lost this trust with each other. But at the same time, I think in the end, the parameters of the final settlement that is going to be stable is going to meet some preconditions for both people. And that's going to define ultimately Israel is going to do what it's going to have to do in terms of concessions, because in the end, it's the only way it's going to be able to exist peacefully in the Middle East.
But the end could be a long way off, and we've got a lot to be done in the interim. Mary's calling from Brighton, Massachusetts. Hi, Mary, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I have a couple of points.
Yes.
One of them being, if we learned anything from the tragedy of 9/11, it is that what happens over there does spill over here. The world does not end in the east and west coast of America, and as Americans, what Bush has done today, the U.S. being a former mediator and now brokering a deal with Israel, it's a unilateral Israeli plan, and nobody has the right to give up Palestinian rights. I can understand the Palestinian people. They have had no say in this, and Sharon is not a man of peace. He has not proven himself to be a man of peace.
Well, they've had a say. They had peace negotiations. They've had a say in the streets. You know, a lot of violence there, Mary.
Yes, but, you know, this is an uneven, unbalanced war, and I do, you know, I resent that a penny of my taxes goes to Israel to support this, you know, uneven war. There's a difference in the might. These people in Palestine have their, you know, nothing but their bodies to blow up, and the Israelis, it's a might, you know, a bullying power that is oppressing the Palestinian people.
Mary, we hear you. I think we're losing you there. Dennis Ross, you have heard this view, and there it is again. You're saying Palestinians, essentially, get real, it's going to be something like this.
Well, what I'm saying is we've had a situation that is completely frozen.
Mm-hmm.
The Palestinians have been unable or unwilling, for a variety of reasons, to do anything on their own, to assume responsibilities. The Israelis have recognized that something has to give, something has to change. The U.S. had really not been very engaged in terms of trying to make an effort. And here, into this frozen situation, which is frozen in the sense that there's no possibility, no movement, no nothing, comes an unprecedented move by an Israeli prime minister.
Dennis Ross, we've got to hold it right there. We'll be right back. This is Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about today's White House agreement between George Bush and Ariel Sharon on the future, laid out unilaterally or bilaterally, but not trilaterally. We're looking at questions about today's agreement's impact on American security and the war in Iraq. My guest tonight from Washington, Shibley Talhami, Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland, and from Bethesda, Maryland, Dennis Ross, a former key U.S. point person on Middle East peace negotiations under the first Bush and the Clinton administrations. I want to go straight to this with each of you, if I may, this bigger issue of U.S. interests in the war on terror, in Mideast reform, in Iraq, and how they, I don't know, sit on a scale or balance or interact with the U.S. interest in Israeli security, in Israeli-Palestinian peace. Shibley, tell me first to you, very broadly, is this U.S. relationship with Israel demonstrated today in the White House, is it compatible with winning Arab buy-in for democratic reform with the big goals that George Bush has set out?
Well, first, if you don't mind, I just want to comment on something that was said earlier about how we break out of this cycle, because I think it is true that we need to have also a Palestinian Authority that is willing to do what is necessary.
Amen.
But, you know, in this particular arena and environment, obviously, how do you do it when you have a weakened, significantly weakened authority, public opinion going south, a changed mood? And
going south, meaning toward Hamas and Hezbollah.
That's right. And what, well, not Hezbollah as such, but Hamas certainly is a Palestinian movement. But if you have that, then what do you do? Well, first, of course, you get put something on the table to empower them. You've got to help them out. You've got to put something on the table. And unlike when Barack put something on the table, there has not been something on the table. That Sharon never said, well, if you can do this, then here is a plan that we can work on together. And even this particular unilateral plan, think about it, and I think Dennis probably agrees with me on this one. If you had Abu Mazen about a year ago as prime minister, that the U.S. was trying to support the roadmap in place, had there been a deal worked out pertaining to unilateral withdrawal from Gaza in the context of an agreement, it would have empowered him, it would have been put something on the table. It would have been a real possibility. It would have been at least useful to test it. It never occurred. So there is a problem there on both sides of how this was managed. But going back to your point, which I think is important, I mean, look, I think we've waged the war on terrorism as if it's only a military campaign. Of course, there's a military campaign to it. The horrible organization like Al-Qaeda, you got to go after them. There's no other way. But you got to remember the recruits out there. And the question is, how do you motivate recruits? And I think it is clear that over the past year, there's been a lot more possible recruits for them. And it's clear that there's more instability in the Middle East, particularly in Iraq, that is playing into the hands of these organizations. The Palestinian issue to this day, in my judgment, remains the prism through which most people in the Middle East view America and America's intentions. And it plays into this motivational factor. And I think we're not coming to grips with it. We're avoiding it. But I think no question that the environment, there is no direct relationship between motivation and terrorism. But there is an indirect relationship. That is, you've got, when you have a lot more resentful and angry and frustrated people, you have a lot more recruits that could be exploited by organizers. And I think that's what we've got now.
Dennis Ross, we've just got a minute and a half left, but step way back for us beyond Israel and Palestinians to this bigger issue. Can George Bush have it all?
Well, he can only have it all if he produces. It isn't going to be done in the form of slogans. It isn't going to be done in the form of declarations. You're going to actually have to show that life changes, that you see, in fact, a reason to be hopeful again. In the Israeli-Palestinian context, both sides have lost hope. The unilateral Israeli move is not a function of success. It's a function, in a sense, of what has been failure. And it's an effort to try to transform the situation. For me, the question is, can you build on it? Can you create what I call two freedoms, freedom for the Israelis from terror, freedom for the Palestinians from Israeli control? And if you do that, it will resonate throughout the rest of the region. Now, I agree with Shibley that when you fight the war on terror, you also have to fight it in terms of how do you reestablish the possibility, the sense of possibility. You know, we are criticized in the Middle East for supporting Israel on the one hand, but also for being seen as propping up regimes that oppress their people.
Yep.
We use democracy as a weapon against those we don't like, but never against those that we do like. What we have to do is show a kind of consistency. We also have to show a kind of effort and a willingness to engage ourselves in such a fashion that we're really prepared to invest, and we produce when we invest. If George Bush is able to show that what he's done today is actually going to materially change things between Israelis and Palestinians, not just in words but in reality, then it will help us across the board.
Well, two big words to meditate on there tonight, consistency and a real investment. Dennis Ross, thank you so much for being with us tonight. Always good talking with you.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Dennis Ross, director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and author of the forthcoming The Missing Peace, the inside story of the fight for Middle East peace. And Shibley Tilhami, author of The Stakes, America in the Middle East, and a senior fellow at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Always great to have you as well. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. In a moment, George Tenet and Robert Mueller in front of the 9/11 Commission. This is On Point. Today's session of the 9/11 Commission hearings featured testimony from CIA Director George Tenet and FBI Director Robert Mueller, front and center in the questioning, why, prior to September 11, 2001, were U.S. intelligence agencies so focused on details and bureaucracy that they missed the big picture of a terrorist threat building against the United States inside the United States? The Commission also probed public confidence in the FBI, notions of creating a U.S. domestic intelligence agency like Britain's MI5, and how information about al-Qaeda was communicated to the president during his vacation that summer in Crawford, Texas, in the weeks before the terrorist attacks. We turn again tonight to Michael Isikoff, investigative correspondent for Newsweek magazine. He was at today's hearings. Michael, welcome back.
Good to be with you.
What was the big news today, sir?
Well, I don't know that there was any bombshell today. You had CIA Director George Tenet indicating that to truly fix all the structural problems within the U.S. intelligence community, it was going to take another 5 years, and I think that kind of grabbed a couple of the commissioners.
Set them back on their heels.
We don't really have 5 years in the midst of this war to do that. Yet, oddly, there was not that much. I didn't think the questioning of either Tenet or FBI Director Robert Mueller was all that aggressive or confrontational. In fact, the questioning of Tenet began with all these encomiums of praise for his tenure as CIA director from many of the commissioners, which stands in stark contrast to some of the findings of the commission staff reports, which really reamed the agency pretty strongly.
And which he was protesting today. But it's the second day in a row, Michael, that you've said the questioning wasn't that tough. Is this commission just getting worn out?
I think that they have pulled back from the blame game, from the finger pointing. It kind of reached its peak, I thought, with Condi Rice last week in the wake of the Richard Clark allegations. I think that they are a little bit hesitant about they don't want to be perceived as partisan. And, in fact, they all make a big deal about the fact that they're working together, that this is a bipartisan commission, that they haven't divided along partisan lines.
Band of brothers and a sister.
That's right. They call each other brothers and sisters. It was interesting, you know, Attorney General Ashcroft yesterday had taken a clear shot at one of the commissioners, Jamie Gorelick,
yes,
a former deputy attorney general under Janet Reno in the Clinton administration, suggesting she was to blame for erecting the wall between intelligence and law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
Today, some of the conservatives in Congress and on the airwaves, Rush Limbaugh, Jim Sensenbrenner, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, called on Gorelick to resign. The commissioners, Republican commissioners, rushed to her defense today, saying that was nonsense. She's been one of the more effective commissioners, and she's really not perceived as a partisan person. It looked more like defenders of the White House and the Bush administration, who fear the commission is going to issue a report that's going to be critical of the Bush White House, are trying to position the commission as being a political body. And the commission seems to be resisting that pretty strongly, both Republican and Democrat.
The Republicans there today shooing away the attack dogs. I want to listen to a little bit of what we heard today. Maybe, Michael, we'll listen here first to an exchange between former Senator, Democrat, Bob Kerry, and George Tenet over what George Tenet had told President Clinton about al-Qaeda.
Did you ever have a conversation with President Clinton where you told him that al-Qaeda was a substantial military effort, that they were responsible for shooting down our helicopters in Mogadishu, that there was a substantial military threat to the United States of America, that we ought to ramp this guy up to the top of the list?
Sir, I will go back and look at my – I didn't come prepared with what happened in 96. I'll go back and look at my records, look at the data dissemination, go back through the meetings that were held at the time, and give you an answer to the question.
I say, Director, this is
– okay, Michael Isikoff, this is the kind of exchange that we were accustomed to hearing around President Bush. Did you tell President Bush on August 6th or earlier in the summer of 2001? This time, Democrat Bob Kerry's going after the
conversations between Tenet and President Clinton. What's he trying to illuminate here?
Well, first of all, Bob Kerry has been pretty consistent on this all along. I mean, he's a former chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, and he has, from the get-go, said that both the Clinton administration and the Bush administration should have taken a much more aggressive military posture with al-Qaeda, that there was plenty of evidence on the table. They had declared, bin Laden had declared war against us. He had launched attacks against us. Mm-hmm. That in and of itself should have triggered the kind of response, and he gets very impatient, and he alluded to this today, at the responses from relevant policymakers at the time, to wit, that there just simply wasn't the national will to declare.
He says, "Get over that. You should have whipped it up. Should have made it."
He says, "You know, it's up to the president of the United States and the administration in power to shape that political will." And you know, I guess the prime example is the war in Iraq, when there probably wasn't a political will in this country to go to war against Iraq.
But we're there.
Bush shaped the debate.
But Michael Iskoff, isn't it kind of incredible if George Tenet indeed never said that sort of thing to President Clinton in all those years?
I think that Kerry was focusing on a very narrow point there as to whether or not there was evidence of al-Qaeda involvement in the attacks in Mogadishu in 1993. My understanding of the intelligence is that it's a little bit shakier than Kerry was presenting it. If, in fact, al-Fadl said that, it wasn't clear that there was corroboration, that we knew that to be sure at that time. Certainly by 98, with the embassy bombings, there wasn't any question that that bin Laden was striking against U.S. interests. He, in fact, bombed two U.S. embassies.
Yeah.
So I don't know that I would put so much weight on just that one narrow point of the Somalia involvement.
Michael, let's go to the Tenet-Bush conversations here. Commission member Tim Romer asks about what President Bush was told during August of 2001.
You didn't see the president between August 6, 2001, and September 10th?
Saw him after Labor Day, to be sure.
So you saw him September 4th at the principal's meeting?
He was not at the principal's meeting.
Well, you don't see
him. Condoleezza Rice. I saw him in this time frame, to be sure.
Okay, I'm just confused. You see him on August 6th with the PDB.
No, I do not, sir. I'm not there.
Okay, you're not there. When do you see him in August?
I don't believe I do.
You don't see the President of the United States once in the month of August?
He's in Texas, and I'm either here or on leave for some of that time, so I'm not here.
So who's briefing him on the PDBs?
The briefer himself.
So there's a picture, Michael. I mean, I saw him after Labor Day, to be sure. It sounds like good old boys trundling back to the office from summer break.
Well, this is exactly where the biggest vulnerability for George W. Bush is on this, the fact that as this gathering storm was taking place in the summer of 2001, these really urgent warnings from the intelligence community that attack could be imminent, the president was on the ranch in Crawford, got that briefing on August 6th, and there does seem to be a gap in finding a definite response, a clear response. What are you going to do? I have a little different take on it. In fact, my colleague and I, Mark Hosenball, write a weekly column on our Newsweek website, newsweek.com, TerrorWatch, in which we examine that PDB, the August 6th PDB. Mm-hmm. And what was most striking to us is just what a lame document, an insubstantial document is. There was a wealth of far more alarming, hard evidence about al-Qaeda plans and operations in the United States that could have been included in that little in that document that would have gotten anybody's attention. Granted, the title was a grabber, but there was much more from the embassy bombing trials about bin Laden efforts to acquire nuclear weapons, from the Rassam trial.
And all the rest just didn't come across. We're out of time, Michael Iskoff. Coulda, woulda, shoulda, I guess, there.
Right, exactly.
Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Anytime.
Michael Iskoff, investigative reporter for Newsweek magazine. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.